Good afternoon. Welcome, everybody. We're going to get started. I am the winded executive director of the Energy and Environment Program for the Aspen Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's session on our energy future, sponsored by Chevron. We have an illustrious panel here, and I'm going to give you the reason I was running back and forth is we didn't have our bios prepared for this session, so I'm going to read the bios for our guests here today. Andy Karsner is the Assistant Secretary of Energy and Efficiency and Renewable Energy. He's the Assistant Secretary. He manages the Department of Energy's $1.47 billion applied science research and development and deployment portfolio. He promotes marketplace integration of renewable and environmentally sound energy technologies, and he was previously Assistant Secretary, served as the International Infrastructure Development and Energy Entrepreneur. And sorry, I'm a little rattled from running around. You'll just bear with me. It'll be all right. Marvin Odom is the Executive Vice President of the Americas for Shell Exploration and Production. He is an affiliate of the Shell Group. That is his exploration and production group. Previously, he served as CEO of Intergen, a global power generation company active in 13 countries and an affiliate of Bechtel Enterprises. Ken Salazar, probably needs no introduction here, was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2004. He's a fifth-generation Coloradan, not an easy thing these days, and is a member of five Senate committees, Agriculture, Energy and Natural Resources, Veterans Affairs, Ethics, and Aging. And who am I missing here? Amory Lovins needs no introduction. But Amory, of course, is the chief scientist, founder, and chairman of the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's also a MacArthur Fellow, and he's currently, or he's the author of an important writing relevant to today's discussion, and that's the Winning the Oil Endgame. And then it's my pleasure to introduce Mr. James Woolsey. He's the former, or served as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's also the vice president of Booz Allen Hamilton, one of our other sponsors for Ideas Festival. And what you might not know is that Jim, his visage, his name has become synonymous with energy security. Jim?
Thank you very much. We're going to have brief opening statements up here. Our subject is fuels for the future. And we've talked about it briefly, and that includes not only fuels to produce electricity, but fuels to drive on. And, of course, there is some overlap, because one thing somebody will talk about a bit, I'm sure, is things like plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles. And the only thing I want to say about any one of our panelists, Andy and I have worked together for the last couple of years with a great pleasure. I've just met Marvin. Amory and I have known each other for nearly 30 years. I wrote the foreword to his book published in '82, Brittle Power. But I especially wanted to mention Senator Ken Salazar, who's played a leading role in the energy bill. It's gone through the Senate, and especially, at least several of us here, especially interested in the plug-in hybrid provisions. There are a lot of other parts of the bill that are worthy, but some of us who are kind of getting electricity into our bloodstream with respect to propelling vehicles around, we're especially thankful and delighted about that. So let's start. Senator Salazar, over to you.
Thank you very much, Jim. First, let me say, as a U.S. Senator from Colorado, welcome to our wonderful state here at Aspen, and we look forward to having the Ideas Festival here time and time again. And to former Senator Gary Hart, who is here in the audience, thank you for teaching me about the importance of security as I sought to be the United States Senator for the state of Colorado.
If anybody has a BlackBerry on, turn it completely off anywhere near a microphone, because that's kind of what you tend to work.
Let me just start out by saying, there you go, Andy Karsner.
Never on the Senate floor, though.
Yeah, never. Well, you're not supposed to on the Senate floor. But let me just say that when I, You know, when I serve as a senator, I'm reminded what Gary Hart told me a long time ago when I was making the decision to run, that before the word senator, representing the 5 million people of the state of Colorado, comes the two words United States, United States Senator. And so in that context, when I get up in the morning and I think about the world that I live in, I try to figure out which are the greatest issues that are facing our nation. And from my point of view, the issues in the way that I would rank them, and they are somehow interconnected, are first foreign relations and how we restore the greatness of America, what happens in Iraq and the Middle East, and how we move forward to putting the world back together again as the legacy of World War II. And my parents and the parents of many people who created us as the great beacon of hope in the world. Secondly, and closely tied to that, is the issue of energy. The clean energy economy, from my point of view, for the 21st century is mightily important. Third, the issue of healthcare and how we try to deal with the issue of healthcare, which bankrupts so many America's families and businesses. And then there are other tough issues like immigration, other sorts of things, but they can tie in very much to the issue of security and national security and how we deal with that. But today, dealing with the issue of energy security, as I often said during the debates in the 2005 Energy Policy Act last year, on the 2006 Act, and then this year, as we move forward with biofuels and efficiencies and carbon sequestration, I told people that I thought the three inescapable forces for us that were very different in 2007 than what they were back in the days of Richard Nixon coining energy independence, or Jimmy Carter talking about energy independence being the moral imperative of war, is that the drivers have changed. Back in the 70s, the drivers were primarily economic. And that's still one of the inescapable drivers and, in fact, opportunities that we have. But there are two additional drivers that really make the clean energy future for the 21st century, I think, an absolute. And that is, first of all, national security and our absolute addiction on foreign oil. In March of this year, we imported 60% of our oil from foreign countries. Much of that oil was coming from grounds that underlie hostile regimes to the United States of America. So that issue of national security is one which will drive us to look at different alternatives on how we reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And then thirdly, environmental security. You know, I think the debate is now over. I think the fact is that we are frying ourselves here in this planet, and we're frying civilization. And so how we deal with the issue of global warming is inextricably tied to how we deal with how we power our economy, how we power our world, how we deal with transportation fuels. So those are, you know, some of the overriding objectives that I bring to the debate. Now, I know Jim said we should be close, so we should not be too long, so I'm going to try to cut this down just a little bit. As I looked at the issue of energy and how we deal with it, I talked to people, as I've done in all 64 counties of this state several times over the last 2 years as senator. I say, yeah, we're going to build a house of energy independence. There are four cornerstones to that house of energy independence. One of them is conservation. You know, when you talk to Andy's in our National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, they say that's the low-hanging fruit. We waste 60% of the oil that we consume here in America. So conservation has to be one of those cornerstones. A second cornerstone, from my point of view, is renewable energy. You know, how can we take the power of the sun, the power of the wind, how can we take the power of our biofuel economy and really create a whole renewable energy economy for our country that will bring in millions of jobs, that will help revitalize rural America, as it is now doing in my state of Colorado for the first time, really in the last 2 years, in major ways across the forgotten eastern plains. Thirdly, the new technologies that deal with hybrid plug-ins, which when you do the calculations that Jim can do, we can get up to 500 miles to a gallon of gas if you do it in the right way and you calculate it with the right kind of batteries, and we have advanced materials in our vehicles, and we create the infrastructure where you can actually have hybrid plug-in vehicles, which are right around the corner. You know, this is not technology that is science fiction technology that's 10 years away. So new technology is the third cornerstone. And the fourth cornerstone is balanced development of our natural resources. You know, today I had the opportunity to spend about 4.5 hours on a helicopter ride with Governor Bill Ritter, flying over the Rhone Plateau, up into northwest Colorado with the Piance Basin, into Rio Blanco County, over to the Vermilion Basin. We live in one of the most spectacular places in God's world. And I look at the western slope and I tell the people of my state, that I don't want to see the sustainability of the Western Slope sacrificed as we march forward without a thoughtful and deliberate way in how we are developing the vast natural resources that we have here in the state of Colorado. And so I have opposed and will oppose the drilling on the top of the Rome Plateau because I think there are other places that we can drill. You know, on the other hand, I'm not opposed to the appropriate development of our natural resources. So I've been one of the people in the Senate that has advocated for IGCC, the internal gasification of coal resources and other resources, because we in this United States have enough coal to basically power our economy for another 200 years. The problem is that when we burn coal, we create a bunch of problems with greenhouse gases. And so we have to burn it right, and we have to figure out a way of sequestering the carbon, and it ties in very much to what we can do with plug-in hybrids. I'm going to cut this down really fast, Jim. Let me just take one last second here to talk about the bill that we just passed in the Senate, which is now over in the House. We'll conference it together. And there are three major pieces that this legislation does with respect to fuels. The first is that it drives, for the first time, a major sense of a policy at the national level that says we will grow our way to energy independence. The vision that we wrote in the bill, Senator Grassley and I co-sponsored the legislation that says we will provide 25% of our fuels by the year 2025 from renewable energy resources. So that's the overall vision. There's about 800 organizations that have endorsed that vision. It was accepted unanimously in the U.S. Senate. Now, what are some of the drivers that will get us there? Well, the first of those is with respect to biofuels. We have moved the renewable fuel standard, which we just adopted in 2005, from 7.5 billion gallons now up to 36 billion gallons by the year 2022. So by the year 2022, we will be producing 32 billion gallons of biofuels and advanced biofuels. Now, we all know there's a limit in terms of how much ethanol we ultimately produce. And so we know from corn. So corn, we know, has a limitation. The Department of Energy and others have told us you reach that limitation when you get to about 15 billion gallons. So the future, really, with respect to biofuels, is not with corn ethanol. The future, with respect to biofuels, is what we do with cellulosic ethanol. And I will tell you that some of the awardees that Andy has given some grants from the Department of Energy have told me that we are within a year to two from being able to crack the door open technologically to be able to commercially deploy cellulosic ethanol. But what is cellulosic ethanol? It is fuel that we basically create from materials that we currently waste. Animal waste out in feedlots and on farms, wood chips that we see on the forests of Georgia and in places here in Colorado. It is anything that is a biomass. And we are probably a year to 3 years away from being able to develop the technology that allows us to start commercially deploying cellulosic ethanol. And when we do that, that's what allows us to move from 15 billion gallons up to the 36 billion gallons, the 36 billion gallons that we included in this legislation. And many of the experts that we talked to say that that is just the beginning of the equation. So this legislation is big on biofuels. We're going to do that from switchgrass, wood waste, ag waste, landfill materials. Secondly, this legislation is also major legislation with respect to efficiency on CAFE standards. We will move up from the current CAFE standards, which have been in place for now over 30 years, to requiring our national vehicle fleets manufactured or sold in the U.S. to get 35 miles per gallon by the year 2020. My belief is that with the new technologies that set America free, that Energy Futures Coalition have advanced, that we'll be able to meet that and exceed that significantly. And third, we take some steps in this legislation to start dealing with the issue of global warming by dealing with the issue of carbon sequestration and trying to map carbon sequestration opportunities around the world today. Let me just conclude by saying there's a lot more work to be done. Mike, the committees that I sit on, finance, passed a major $28 billion tax incentive package to make these efficiencies in biofuels, alternative fuels, a reality. And we hope that by the time it gets to the president's desk, that finance package is also included in there. Our agriculture committee, Title IX of the agriculture bill, which is being written, which expires now September 2007, is titled The Energy Future for Rural America. It's a great opportunity to revitalize all of rural America. We're going to be spending a significant amount of energy on that. And thirdly, the Energy Committee that I sit on obviously is going to be dealing with all these issues that are interrelated, and they were the key authors. We were the key authors of the legislation that was just approved by the Senate. We have a long ways to go, but I think we have gotten a great start over the last couple of years.
Bravo. Let me just say that Senator Salazar, by his committee memberships, his inherent ability representing this fine state, the heart of a lot of energy issues, he gave just a very straightforward and wonderful presentation of what had happened. But from the outside looking in, let me just say he has been extraordinarily instrumental in the Senate moving in some very positive ways with this just very recently, and we're all deeply grateful. Let me say to my other panelists that it's important that everything important be said, but it's not important that everybody say it. And since Senator Salazar covered a number of issues, I'd ask the other panelists to be as brief as they possibly can. So, Marvin, over to you.
Sounds like good guidance. So, thanks. One of the things I'll avoid is the security topic. That angle of the energy challenge is out there, and I will focus some more on the environment, in addition to what the senator had to say. Sometimes I think it's helpful to state what some of your assumptions are going into a certain conversation. So there's four assumptions, very basic, probably well understood by everybody, but they do have a lot to do with what I think about this topic, so I thought I would state those quickly. The first one is population growth. Now, so I'm thinking on a global basis, and I'm thinking of dramatic population growth. So between now and 2050, which is really the time frame all of my comments refer to, talking about population growth from a current 6 billion people up to around 9 billion people. So that leads to the second assumption, and that is we're going to have a dramatic increase in the demand for energy, all types of energy, and it's going to take virtually everything we can do to fill that demand. When I say dramatic increase in energy, I'm talking about a doubling of what we produce to meet that demand today, a doubling by 2050. Which has an error bar around it, of course, but I think it's a reasonable assumption. The third assumption is that there's a huge promise around alternative and sustainable energies. And I mean that in a very positive way. On this promise, these are real things, and we can put them to work, and they can make a big difference for us. But we also know that 80 to 85% of the current energy mix is hydrocarbons, and we have to deal with that part of the component as well. So I'll make a couple of comments on that front. Now, how quickly we make that shift from hydrocarbons to alternative and sustainable energy is, I think, one of the biggest challenges we face. And of course, there's a lot of people on this panel that are actually driving the speed at which we will be able to do that. Fourth assumption is we have to address climate change and the linkage that it has to fossil fuels, because I do think they will be a big part of the mix for quite a while into the future. If I could just make a couple of brief comments, not to duplicate what was said on some of those fuels of the future, then what are they? From a fossil fuel standpoint, being the oil company guy up here, it probably makes sense for me to make a couple of comments on that. One is that I agree with the statements that you tend to hear a lot, that we're not running out of oil. I don't think that's the issue, but I do think what the issue is that it's getting to be where you can only find it in very difficult places. It's expensive to get to, and it takes a long time. So I think we may actually, in this transition period, run into some supply limitations as that matches up with demand. And the example I would use there is when we go out looking for big sources of hydrocarbons, it's one of the things we do. When we find one now, it's anywhere from 5 to 15 years before we actually get the first production of energy out of that source. So you can see the time lag, and you can see the potential limitations on delivering consistent with demand increases. Coal's already been discussed, but I just wanted to broaden it to a global picture, because I think we have to assume, again, linking to the environmental side, that coal will be used. So we know that it's over 50% of our electric power generation today. It's over 70% in China. And China's growing, having once been in the power business, this number just amazes me. China's growing at 50 gigawatts plus or minus a year, with most of that being coal. So that's the equivalent of all the energy produced, all the electrical energy produced in Great Britain being duplicated in China every year. So the linkage with greenhouse gas there and the need to address that issue is pretty clear. That's why I think the clean coal technologies that were mentioned, be it coal gasification, coal to liquids, maybe we can talk about that some more in the Q&A, will play a very important role going forward. On the renewable side, I'm going to leave my comments very brief here. Just, you know, wind, solar, hydrogen, and biofuels, all big opportunities, I think, on the wind side. You know, we're running into this kind of issue as we try to expand our wind business. Some places it works in southeastern Colorado, as a matter of fact. We've got a joint project where we supply the power to something greater than 50,000 homes. At the same time, we're trying to put a project off the Thames Estuary called the London Array, which has had great support by NGOs and a lot of different people, politicians as well. But we can't get the substation built onshore to bring the power onshore. That project by itself, pure wind, would supply about 1% of the UK's power. So wind is great. We're having some difficulty getting it impacted, and I think that will come back in a policy discussion maybe later. Solar, we're moving to the next generation of solar, which is the thin film solar. And I think I just wanted to point that out because I think it's significant, and that as we get to mass production of solar power, the thin film technology uses about 100 times less raw materials to develop it. So you can see in a mass production sense, that's going to be a critical factor. Hydrogen, let's do it in the Q&A. It's important, but I think it's pretty far out there in terms of having a big impact. And I would just second the comments on biofuels. From a policy perspective, I think, you know, I've heard Andy make this point several times, and I completely agree with it, that the pace of change, the urgency around change in this transition is going to be driven by governments and policy. It's not going to be driven by companies like mine or others. But sitting in my chair, there are some things, it's simplistic, but I think it's good to be specific, some things that, you know, I would look for to hope to see from government. Some of those things are actually happening now, and Andy's pushed them very hard. One is around the greenhouse gas topic, CO2, is a cap and trade system that at least addresses this country and broadens itself to as many countries around the globe as quickly as possible. Absolute targets for renewable energy, you know, Andy's 20 and 10, I think is a good example of that. Addressing transport policy, so cleaner fuels, better efficiency for automobiles, an absolute must. And then carbon capture and sequestration. Being in the, you know, largely in the fossil fuels business, we have to have the support for the capture of carbon and the sequestration to keep it out of the air. And there's a certain amount of policy work that's required to get that done. I'll stop there.
Well, Marvin, thank you very much. And let me just add that I'm familiar with Shell's work on solar and wind, and they are dedicated and moving fast and making a real contribution. And for those of you who have a cynical attitude with respect to what oil companies might do to compete with oil, let me just say that up there in Ontario at facility is the first cellulosic ethanol plant in the world, a little company called Iogen. The principal investor is Shell. So we have, I think, in Marvin and in the company, a lot of very positive work going forward in the renewables area. Andy?
Carter.
Thanks. Thanks, Jeb. First, let me say it's not my 2010, it's the president's 2010. But since Senator Salazar's up here and was instrumental in passing it through the Senate, let me say it's the Senate's and Senator Salazar's 2010. Hopefully, it'll become the House's 2010 also. And let me just begin that way, too, by complimenting you, Senator, because I made the point this morning, you weren't here, that the old lines don't really matter anymore. This isn't a discussion between Republicans and Democrats anymore. This is the informed, the uninformed, and those who refuse to be informed. And in fact, I would add a fourth category with you here. It includes the very informed. Your leadership has been instrumental, and that's why we've raised the funding here in Colorado by 50% and made NREL the hub of global activity. And the Prime Minister of Sweden coming here a couple weeks ago, the Prime Minister of Denmark, big delegations from China and Brazil and India focusing on Colorado because it is the epicenter of thinking. This is the only place in the world where you will find an operational cellulosic biorefinery operation. And so I appreciate your leadership very much. I won't be repetitive except to say that the characteristics of the 2010 and the legislation that passed are very important into the general discussion about fuel diversification. And I'm going to focus only on transportation fuels. If anybody wants to talk about solar and wind, happy to do that in Q&A. But we need anything we can throw at our current oil addiction. and anything that is that has the correct attributes for the nation. That is to say, will it be clean? Will it be affordable? Will it be abundant? Will it be available? Will it be domestic and secure and reliable? So we're more about the attributes than in choosing technology winners or in choosing the particular fuel sources, because as you've heard up here, we will need them all. And there won't be a silver bullet. It really will look more like silver buckshot. And our goal at the Department of Energy is to perfect these multiple different technology pathways. Well, let me say something uniquely about our shop, since I can give that perspective. It is not exclusively renewables when we come to this question, because we have the nation's vehicle technology program. And the vehicle technology program, in its history, has unfortunately leaned one way or excessively during periods of time towards a given portion of its mission. That is to say, through the 70s and 80s, when it was pursuing the EV1 technology and exclusively on a plug-in without a combustion source a powertrain, with some success, arguably, it went to that. We went off of that. And through the 90s, we got into something called the Project for the Next Generation Vehicle, where it was all about vehicles that could be 70 miles per gallon, 80 miles per gallon. And we went into that. We went off of that. We had the president's five-year hydrogen fuel initiative with $1.2 billion invested. We went to that. We went off of that. All of these programs have yielded results, have yielded technology spinoffs, and have driven prices down the cost curve. But all of them also failed to get to the big picture, because they imagine the role of government being limited exclusively to long-term pre-market R&D, and to some extent, that is where government plays best, because it's where it's easiest to cooperate with industry and get everybody around the table. But the truth is that if you look at the time value that we discussed this morning, the urgency of the exercise, government also has a role, not just in the science and technology, but in the connectivity to the policy, like those that are being debated and put forth from the Senate and the President, that can enable capital formation. Because if the technology is not a constraint, and I would assert that it is not, and the capital markets have the availability, it is really about what must we do to allow that capital to aggregate and form at a rate that is unprecedented and in a continuous manner to deploy these various technologies through our vehicles and enable them for multiple fuel sources. So our focus now is flexibility, that is to say multiple fuel sources, a car that can choose between any blend of biofuel and have electric hybridization with it, preferably hybridization that you could plug in to your home so that you might be like the average American, having a 15-mile commute daily and not have to see a gas station for months if we can make the lithium-ion battery charge last for 30 or 40 miles per day in between charges. So a flexible platform with highly efficient vehicles. And I don't want to step on Amory's thunder here, but if you've read his book, you will see the importance of lightweighting and carbon composites and compression ratios and all of those things that we work into. And I don't want to leave off the hydrocarbons, because we also do substantial work and have made substantial achievements on clean diesel, both on the technology side and on the development of the fuels. And of course, there is up to a 40% efficiency gain by moving our national fleet towards greater diesel utilization like you have in most of the industrial world. So all of these things will be big pictures of the pie, but time matters, and so it matters too that the government get its perspective correct and not exclusively focus on shoving things into the front end of the pipeline and then pretending that they go through the magic mirror of transformation and say, now the market will take it from here, because we know that there are sufficient market imperfections that have to be bridged by government involvement. And so what you're really talking about is the difference between market-driven policies or policy-driven markets. And it's a careful nuance, but devising that policy today that can be sufficiently disruptive to meet with the externalities that the market can't account for, particularly when you talk about the environmental criteria and climate change and national security, et cetera, is really the imperative that we have in Washington. And we're blessed with good fortune on both sides of the island and senators like Senator Salazar, who are seeing that we can make these changes happen.
Andy, thank you very much. And let me add that Andy has made a big mark just in the year and a half, year and a half.
About that.
That he's been in
since addiction to oil.
In this job in Washington, a huge mark, a bigger mark than is publicly known. And I think there is a good chance that in no small measure because of him, we're going to see some important progress over the course of the remainder of this administration, as well as hopefully in a next administration of whatever party on these issues. And finally, Amory, you're on.
The biggest energy resource we're using right now, which has been mentioned in passing, is more efficient use of whatever fuels and power we are consuming. The United States is now saving each year, compared with how inefficient we were in 75, more energy than Europe uses. compared with 75, last year we used 48% less total energy to make a dollar of real GDP. 54% less oil, 64% less directly used natural gas, also, by the way, two-thirds less water, and 17% less electricity. It's the most costly form of energy, the most lucrative to save, but its efficiency is lagging behind for a number of straightforward reasons, the most important of which is that 48 states, still including this one, reward utilities for selling you more electricity and penalize them for cutting your bill. That's just as dumb as a possum, and we should stop doing it. In fact, we do have a rapidly spreading wave of reform in that direction, and that's the biggest lever for saving both electricity and natural gas. If we fully apply the best efficiency techniques now on the market, we can, going forward, save half of our oil at a fifth of its price, half of our gas at an eighth of its price, and at least three quarters of our electricity at an eighth of its price. So that is both a huge business opportunity and a huge business risk for anybody who invests in costly supply on the assumption that that overhanging efficiency will not get bought while you're trying to pay off your debt. And there are many in the energy industries with thick scar tissue from the last time they made that mistake in the mid-80s. The United States last year used 3% less electricity and 4% less total energy to make a dollar of GDP than we did the year before. Nobody noticed. This is even though our light vehicle efficiency has been essentially stagnant for 20 years, and we still have that perverse incentive penalizing electric efficiency and gas efficiency in 48 states. So if you look at how quickly we would need to save energy worldwide in order to stabilize climate, it's only about 3% a year. We're already there in this country. California is a percentage point faster than the U.S. at large. China is a percentage point faster than that for 24 years through 2001, and they're getting that back on the rails this year because energy efficiency is now China's top strategic priority for national development. They know they can't afford to develop otherwise because the supply side eats the budget. and companies that pay attention are increasing their energy productivity by about 6 or 8% a year at huge profits, often measured in the billions. So if it only takes about a 3% increase in energy productivity per year worldwide to stabilize climate, and if everybody who's done a lot faster than that makes money on it, why should this be so hard and why should it cost money? The whole climate debate has been misframed as who will pay the cost rather than who will get the profits. We got the sign wrong. Efficiency is cheaper than fuel. As soon as we realize that, the remaining political obstacles to climate protection will melt faster than glaciers. Now, in our work co-sponsored by the Pentagon, Winning the Oil Endgame, which you can get free at oilendgame.com, we lay out a roadmap for getting the U.S. completely off oil by the 2040s, led by business for profit, because it costs only a quarter as much to get off oil as to keep on buying it, assuming that all its hidden costs are worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. So we showed how to redouble the efficiency of using oil at an average cost of $12 a barrel. That includes tripling the efficiency of cars, trucks, and planes with respective paybacks at U.S. fuel prices of 2 years, 1 year, and 4 or 5 years. Just making cars ultra light and giving them hybrid electric drive and low drag triples their efficiency. That's like finding a Saudi Arabia under Detroit. Make them out of carbon composites, and a process for doing that cost effectively is now being commercialized less than an hour's drive from here in Glenwood Springs. Now, the half of the oil that we don't save can be displaced by a combination of cellulosic ethanol and saved natural gas at an average cost of $18 a barrel. So the average cost of getting off oil is half 12 and half 18. That's $15 a barrel. That's about a quarter of what we're paying right now. You can see why it's profitable. And we're making very good progress in implementing this potential through the private sector, through what we call institutional acupuncture, which means figuring out where the business logic is congested, not flowing properly, and sticking needles in it to get it flowing. We have, among other things, two transformational projects going on in the auto industry right now, either of which could flip that industry. Very exciting developments in aviation, military, heavy trucks led by Walmart. And I'm very excited by how this is going. I think in another year or two, we'll be able to say that all six sectors that need to change have passed their tipping point irreversibly. I want to end by mentioning a revolution going on in electric supply, just so you'll realize the revolution already happened. Sorry if you missed it. Micropower is the Economist magazine's term for either cogeneration, that is, combined production of electricity and useful heat together in factories or buildings, or decentralized renewables, all renewable sources of electricity except big hydro. Together, those two kinds of micropower now provide a sixth of the world's electricity, a third of the world's new electricity, anywhere from a sixth to over half of all electricity in 13 industrial countries. This is no longer a fringe activity. It was a $56 billion market last year just for the renewable part, well over $100 billion for all micropower. When you add to that negawatts, efficient use of electricity, and demand response, together, micropower and demand-side savings of electricity now provide over half the world's new electrical services. Central stations, nuclear, coal, gas-fired, big hydro, have less than half the world market. Why? Because they cost too much and they have excessive financial risk. Nuclear isn't even financeable in the private capital market. So I would end with the heretical suggestion that we don't actually need everything. We can't afford everything. If climate and security are a problem, we need the most solution per dollar and the most solution per year. If, for example, you buy a new nuclear kilowatt hour for somewhere around 8 to 11 cents plus delivery, add 3 cents for delivery, you could use that to displace a kilowatt hour coal power, which sounds good for climate protection. On the other hand, if you took the same dime, more or less, and bought efficiency, cogeneration, and distributed renewables with it, you would get 2 to 10 times more coal savings for the same money. If you don't do that, you're making things worse. So we need to invest judiciously, not indiscriminately, to solve problems like climate change, the spread of nuclear weapons, other security issues, oil security, top of my list. I think if we do that, we'll find we have way more cost-effective and indeed highly profitable technologies already available than we can shake a stick at. We just need to stop insisting that the market buy the turkeys and allow the market to do what it's good at, which is best buys first. So if we let all ways to save or produce energy compete fairly, regardless of which kind they are, what technology they use, where they are, how big they are, or who owns them, these problems will fade away as an artifact of not having used energy in a way that saves money. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
Let me say that I first met Amory nearly 30 years ago, not too long after he wrote a seminal work on renewable energy, soft power, I forget the title of it, in Foreign Affairs. That's 76.
Energy Strategy, the Road Not Taken, 1976.
76.
And in 2000, we were within about 3% of that soft path energy use.
And I wrote a foreword to a book he wrote in 1982, Brittle Power. I would just say that I've recently submitted a chapter for a collection on global warming and national security, and it involves a joint planning session for an energy policy for the U.S. between what I call a tree hugger and a hawk. And the hawk is mainly interested in protecting the country, not in attacking somebody else. But that's his focus. The tree hugger is the ghost of John Muir, and the hawk is the ghost of George S. Patton. And they agree remarkably on a great deal. Since I'm writing both, it's not too hard to make that happen. But they both, if you listen very closely, if you read this someday, they both sound a lot like Amory Lovins. And the reason is that he has done such a wonderful job over the years at pulling together, for a lot of us, the notion of a sound approach toward the environment and a deep concern about national security and things like electricity, grid vulnerability, and all the rest, going back a long time. I think we're all very much in his debt. I am going to turn to the audience after I say just a word or two here. I was going to have a dialogue up here, but we got shaved a little at the beginning on time, so we'll have close to half an hour for Q's and A's. Let me just make a couple of points first. This overall subject of fuels, up until very recently, one would have said, well, okay, if we're going to talk about vehicle fuels, that's oil products, and alternative biofuels like cellulosic ethanol. And if we're going to talk about fuels for electricity generation and power plants and homes and so forth, that's a completely separate subject. That's coal and nuclear and wind and such. Because today, of course, only about 2% of the United States' electricity comes from oil, and only about 7%, I think, worldwide of electricity comes from oil. So one thing you know, by the way, if anybody tells you they're going to solve the oil import problem by building nuclear power plants, or for that matter, wind farms, no, they're not. They're going to solve maybe 2% because we don't use oil the way we did in the 20s, in the 70s, to produce electricity. Those vehicle and electricity issues, up until very recently, are quite separate issues. Today, the very interesting thing that I think is beginning to happen is that the real possibility of being able to see by a couple of years from now plug-in hybrids in dealer showrooms, and Bob Lutz, the vice chairman of General Motors, Mr. V12, Mr. Escalade, was on NPR about 3 weeks ago saying we are going into production in 2010 with a plug-in hybrid, and he it sounded like the president of the Sierra Club. This was a very interesting development. I think that what is happening here is that the skyrocketing capabilities of particularly lithium-ion, but some other types of batteries, and the continued reduction in cost over the course of the last few years, it's not quite what was happening to computer chips a few decades ago, but it is in that ballpark. Those changes are making feasible the ability to integrate the transportation and electricity market to the benefit of both. Because not only can one plug in overnight, and for in much of the country, a kilowatt hour is about 5 cents a kilowatt hour at off peak at night, drive 25 miles or so for 25, 30, 40 cents the next day that you paid last night, that is close to a penny a mile. Gasoline is going for 10, 12, 14 cents a mile today. So you're talking something in the ballpark of an order of magnitude reduction in driving costs for an average American car driver coming up before too long. The other piece of this is vehicle to grid. If you charge your plug-in hybrid at night at home, and by the way, everybody knows, if you drive 30, 40 miles in your plug-in hybrid, you get to the end of the charge, you don't have to stop and plug it in again. It just becomes a regular hybrid. So it's like driving a regular Prius until you plug it in again, and then it goes all electric. Well, if you have a vehicle-to-grid arrangement, which requires very, very little change in the existing grid, you plug your car in at night in your garage when you get home, and let's say it charges, and it's now at midnight, it's been there 6 hours or so, it's ready to be driven, and it has nothing to do, and it's full of electricity. What can you do? Well, you can leave it plugged in, have a deal with the utility, that the utility can use it for stabilization, along with other vehicles, for stabilization of the grid, for what's called ancillary services, for standing by in order to deal with power outages, spinning reserves, they call it. Those two relatively small undertakings of the electricity grid, about 5% of its use alone, cost about $12 billion a year, mainly in natural gas. So now you have, among the plug-in hybrid owners and the utilities, $12 billion that you've saved just by not that many plug-in hybrids being available to serve those missions for the utility. What does that mean? FERC Commissioner Mollenhoff's recent briefing and some work by Professor Kempton at the University of Delaware both suggest you're talking in the range of $1,000 to $2,000 a year per car that would be paid for your making it available for those services. So now you go into the dealer's showroom and he says, you know, I'm not a very good salesman, but there are two things you might be interested in about this car. One is that you can drive for 30, 40 miles at a tenth the cost of driving on gasoline. And by the way, it's a flexible fuel vehicle, so when you get beyond that, you can drive on cellulosic ethanol and whatever you've got in the tank. That's the first thing. 10% of your previous cost might not be bad. And the other thing you should know is if you plug it in and leave it plugged in overnight and have a deal with your utility, you can pick up an extra $1,000 to $2,000. And let's see, that pays maybe a third of your car payments. Now, I'm not a very good car salesman, I don't think, but I think even I could sell cars with those facts. Open to your questions. Yes, sir. Address it to any one of us or all of us or whatever.
This is addressed to Avery primarily. Could you give us a two-part question? Could you give us a time estimate for plug-in hybrids? And do you think that it's going to be done by domestic companies like General Motors who haven't had a great track record or a great interest up until now? Or will it be done by the Japanese? So the time and who?
Emery?
I think you'll probably see them first from Toyota, which is reportedly doing three-shift engineering on them to start introducing them. We don't know where or at what scale in model year 2008, which starts, which runs for years starting this October. So by sometime maybe fall '09, you'll probably see some on the market. And they're capable of scaling up very quickly. The catch in plug-in hybrids is not so much the life or the safety of the batteries, those can be engineered, but the cost of the batteries. That's why Jim's last remark is so important. If you also, when your car is parked at the office, have it pluggable in to sell some of that stored juice back to the utility on the hottest afternoons when they're willing to pay over a buck a kilowatt hour for it, then that can help very materially to pay for your batteries while unloading the grid and saving a lot of natural gas. So we actually have a project going on with some tier ones and other interesting players at the moment to figure out exactly how that business model works and to get the technology to market.
Yes, sir.
My question is regarding diesel energy efficiency. Anybody who's driven in Europe would know that you get into a car and you can suddenly go 400 kilometers at great speed. And you go fill tank up and you find out it's a diesel car. The technology for diesels has been available. I'm listening to this panel looking into the future and continually predicting better batteries and better grids and all that good stuff. And so why are we shying away from technology that is guaranteed to give us results? And that's developed today.
Some of this has been environmental standards. Andy, you want to take that?
Well, I can tell you the department doesn't shy away from it. I mean, it's a substantial part of our vehicle technologies program. And in fact, I would say it's the opposite of shy away. I mean, what you have is that we have elevated the standards. The United States now has the highest standards in the world for clean diesel fuels and for clean diesel engines, higher than Europe. In fact, it's part of the dialogue I just had last week in Europe about how to coordinate the timing for further alignment in regulation so that manufacturers aren't unduly penalized. But having said that, so we're in an interim lull right now where Volkswagen and some of the other suppliers in this market in the passenger vehicle side of things have had to pull their models to now comply with the new standard. So you're seeing a new Mercedes out there with the BlueTEC technology. You're seeing a new Cummins-run Daimler Chrysler Hemi that's coming out for SUVs and heavy-duty trucks. And you'll see those rolling out increasingly in the future years. The big challenge is that we currently export diesel fuels to Europe, and Europe exports gasoline to us. We have a refining crunch, and we have to have a better rationalization of retail products. But our hope is that as we coordinate these standards with these better engines and can lower the emissions and increase the efficiency of the engines, that we'll have much greater fleet penetration in light-duty passenger fleets, and that a higher level of CAFE that hasn't moved in 20 years will be helpful in inducing more manufacturers to bring those aboard. So we're very bullish on it.
Diesels are a very good technology if they meet your fine particulate and NOx standards. And we didn't assume them in winning the oil and gas game because we noticed, talking to public health experts, that the fine particulate standards keep getting tighter and tighter as we learn more that that's really quite a dangerous thing to inhale. And it's not clear in the long run yet whether the filters and other control techniques can keep up with that. If so, then we can save even more oil. However, be a little careful about mile per gallon or driving range comparisons, because diesel oil has more energy per gallon than gasoline and more carbon per gallon. And for that reason, it doesn't save significant carbon per mile. However, there is a new, by the way, Colorado technology being developed by Sturman Industries over in Woodland Park that did its first test run in January. That's a digital engine, which could be diesel or other kinds, and it can do lots of different kinds of cycles on the fly, burning any fuel very cleanly with about half, again, as good efficiency as a diesel. I would also say in the big picture, it doesn't really matter whether diesels make it or not. Modern diesels are very good. But here's why I don't care. If you make your car very light and if you make it a good hybrid to start with, like a Prius, say, and you drive it right, not the way Consumer Reports says to, you'll roughly double its efficiency. If you then make it very light and slippery, you double its efficiency again. Now you're using a quarter of the oil per mile that you're used to. If you run it on cellulosic E85 ethanol, you save another factor four. Now you're using a 16th of the oil per mile that you're used to. You make it a plug-in hybrid, you save at least half again. Now you're using 3% the oil per mile that you used to. Then we can argue about hydrogen displacing the last 3% and maybe the cellulosic ethanol. And there's a lot of interesting ways to do that that can make sense and make money. But the engine improvements are just one more part of a big menu, and we don't need the whole menu. We have so many attractive things to do.
Okay, those were both great answers. I'm going to take two questions from over here, because one from each person. Well, one question and question only, no statement, please, from questioners, and short answers as possible from the floor, I mean from the podium. Yes.
Bill Hasseltine, we've seen enthusiasm for alternative energies before, and companies that have invested and investors who have invested and have lost a lot of money. Is there a policy such as a guaranteed price for alternative energy that you would consider, maybe to the senator or anyone else would like to answer that question? How can we make sure that these companies get into business and stay in business and don't get driven out of business?
Let Senator Salazar take that.
Go ahead.
We'll let him, you answer this one and then we'll let him ask one. I just took two from this microphone, so I was being fair to that microphone.
You know, in short, the kinds of incentives that the federal government has put into place are grants, guaranteed loans, tax incentives, tax credits, and the like. The problem with most of those that we've had the last several years is that they've had a very short time horizon. And so, for example, if you take any of the production tax credits, they really are now they are now scheduled to expire within a couple of years. You know, the private sector, you know, you need to have a longer term horizon in terms of your investment. And so what we actually have in this legislation, if we ultimately are able to get it to the president's desk, is an extension of all of these incentives on an average to about the year 2016. We think that that's a long enough period to be able to incentivize the development and deployment of these technologies and pass the baton on over to the private sector.
Equivalently, we could phase out the subsidies to everything else.
That's right.
Yes.
I have a quick question regarding infrastructure and distribution. If we've had 100 years to build out the gasoline infrastructure, and what I've been told is that ethanol at a level of like E85 is corrosive and can't be transported in that, how do we build out that infrastructure? What is the cost and the time frame for something like that?
You're talking mainly about pipelines. And ethanol is not pipeline friendly, to put it mildly. It's one of the reasons behind the increased interest in butanol as an alternative liquid fuel. But cellulosic ethanol does not need to be grown in corn country. The ethanol that's derived from corn, 10%, will probably end up being around 10% of the country's gasoline supply replacement. As Senator pointed out, you need to taper off and get away from that after you hit to about that point. But once you've done that and your alternative liquid fuels, whether it's renewable diesel or biodiesel or especially cellulosic ethanol or butanol, anything from grasses, from agricultural waste, from municipal waste, all these feedstocks, those are distributed everywhere. So you can have, in principle at least, relatively small facilities quite near the feedstocks and also near where they're needing to be used. You don't need central, and there's actually no reason to have big central refineries and pipelines going all over the country. At least that would be my answer. Do you want to add anything?
There's not much I can add other than I just think about the things we're doing today. And so the first easy step is a blend that's, 15% or less, and you can include that in kind of the normal distribution systems. Then I think you think exactly like you were saying, where is it going to be produced? And then you just start to build out the infrastructure that's required from that central point out. And it happens as the market and the economy lets it happen.
If I can bring it down just to a reality here in Colorado, Senator Gil Schwartz is here. She's visited a biodiesel refinery in the poorest county. This is the poorest county in the United States of America, Costilla County in my native San Luis Valley. The county has developed its own biodiesel refinery. It's in the county warehouse. What they do is they take canola, take the oil out, and create biodiesel. So they have it there on site. And many farmers in my state here in Colorado are essentially trying to develop their biodiesel refinery right on their farm. So it relates to the Jim's response. The other thing is, though, on the infrastructure, when you're talking about mass scale, one of the things that we've done on this energy legislation is through an effort of Senator Thune and myself, has created huge incentives for the gasoline stations to essentially have dispensers for alternative fuels. And that's by essentially taking the CAFE penalties, which have built up over time, and deploying them out to try to create this new infrastructure. But the question is right on. It's not just a matter of producing the biofuel, but it's also a question of how it gets to the user of the biofuel.
Great. We got time for, we can go until about 5 after, I think.
And the question is, what are the real facts of life about corn-based ethanol in terms of soil BTU inputs, carbon inputs, outputs, and so forth? Get it out of the political arena and tell us what the real facts are.
Andy's really good. Tony, you want to do this
one? Yeah.
Yeah,
we can all comment on this.
I'll take it and see Amory grade me on it and see how I do. Our laboratories are pretty clear that there is nothing less than carbon neutrality and perhaps up to 40% carbon savings, although it is a range on a well-to-wheels basis for conventional corn-based ethanol processes. Why you have that range depends on what is the prime mover or the power or the energy source at the point of distillation in the ethanol refinery. So newer ones are much more efficient than older ones. Ones that operate on natural gas or recovered methane chain or closed-loop systems that are highly efficient obviously have more savings on a well-to-wheel basis than something that might be contemplated, for example, on coal, which mercifully is a minority in the production of corn-based and conventional ethanol. The important thing about corn-based and conventional ethanol is that people don't pit it against cellulosic ethanol and say, well, it's this virtuous one against this bad one. Because the truth is the current boom in the ethanol based on conventional sources is what is leading us to evolve very rapidly to deal with the infrastructure issues, the transportation issues, the terminaling issues, the dispersion of an alternative domestic biorefining capacity that ultimately must pass that transom where food versus fuel finds its equilibrium, both in terms of pricing and supply, where we think it's 12 to 15 billion gallons, but you know the market will find that in the very near future, we think in the next 36 to 48 months. And then we are hoping for a graceful transition into the cellulosic sources, that it is our mission to stand up here with the help of our labs by 2012, a commercial scale biorefinery. And we think we can meet or beat that and then proliferate these using the infrastructure of the current conventional biofuels economy as the precursor, so that hopefully as we move beyond E10 and into a greater diffusion of E85, and at the same time, intermediate blends, E15 and E20, but all the while displacing gasoline, eroding our oil addiction, conventional ethanol is the necessary precursor to the future of biobutanol, pentanol, cellulosic ethanol, and other alcohols that will be distributed with completely different forms of infrastructure.
Okay, thank you. We've got 5 minutes left, and there's a questioner behind you. Okay. So I got to let him go first. If we have any more time, then we can let you. You've done one, right? Was this yours? No. I'm sorry. I didn't think. Okay, go ahead. Then go ahead. I thought you would ask the last question.
Question for each panelist. One little bit. We haven't talked much about CO2. 45 billion tons a year of CO2 going up there right now. 2/3 of it from fossil fuels. We all know the numbers. By 2030, that's going to, pick your number, 65, 70, and maybe a good number by then would be 20. Do you favor capping CO2 emissions, as in the bills currently before Congress?
Let's take the other question, too, and we'll answer them both up here before we go.
Yes. I just wanted some comments on battery technology, where it's headed. Tesla has lithium batteries. The rest are still using metal hydride. To go across country in a Tesla, you got to venture to get it down to where you can probably charge it for 10 to 15 minutes, and you can't do that yet. Where are we in that technology? What do you see ahead?
Let's start with the CO2. Who wants to take this? Go ahead.
Well, so a couple of quick thoughts on the CO2. So, sitting here as an oil company representative and as an individual, the answer is absolutely yes. I favor a cap. I think a cap and trade system works best. It's my personal preference, but only in combination with a number of the other things that I mentioned in the opening remarks. I think you have to match that up with carbon capture and sequestration. So it's not just, you know, a cap and trade kind of system, but you have to let that system recognize the fact that if you have a coal plant and you capture that CO2 and you sequester it somehow, that there's credit there. Huh? That's a real savings in terms of what's going into the market. I got to make one final comment. It's no matter how, personal view, you know, no matter how quickly we can grow this alternative energy wedge, and I think it can grow actually very quickly, there's going to be a lot of fossil fuels out there. And we talk about this 550 parts per million in the atmosphere as being at least one version of a kind of a maximum limit that we want to reach. In 2030, 2050, let's say, because that's the time frame I think of, you would have to capture the CO2 from 90% of the coal and gas-fired power plants to reach, you know, not to exceed that limit. So I think it just points to the extreme concern and need, and yes, I'd be in favor of it.
Okay, on batteries, Amory?
Well, actually, on that point, running a coal, or for that matter, nuclear plant that costs nothing to build is more expensive than saving the electricity, or at least 3/4 of it, with present technology. So I think rather than having to clean up a lot of those plants, we're going to be able to shut them down and make money on the deal.
Yeah, I think Amory's absolutely right. If you can save it to begin with, that's the best way to go.
And your company's already made $1.6 billion profit, achieving its operational carbon reductions 8 years early.
Energy efficiency is a good thing.
Senator, are you going to miss that question?
No, both questions. You know, global warming, you'll see a huge debate on that probably in the month of September in Washington. And I don't think the question, as I said in my opening comments, is about whether or not something should be done. You still have my colleague and good friend Jim Imhoff who says that that's not the case, but the reality of it is I think the scientific community and the leadership of the country, both on the Democratic and Republican side, recognizes we have to do something. I support a cap and trade system, looking very much forward to the formula that works. You know, on the battery question, when we talk about plug-in hybrids, a very significant part of the R&D that is being worked on, whether it's Toyota or whether it's the big three in Washington, D.C., is how we move forward with the kind of batteries that can store the kind of energy that we're talking about. So there's a huge investment that's going on in terms of R&D and huge progress, technological breakthroughs that are occurring now.
And I think a lot of us are concerned about where the batteries come from. We don't want to build up the kind of dependence, for example, on Asian sources that we have in many other technologies. When we have some very good technology at home,
if I may just intersect on that question, you know, I think what happened in the 1970s under President Nixon after OPEC was formed, and then Jimmy Carter when the National Renewable Energy Lab was brought here to Colorado, to Golden, there was a huge amount of interest and investment in developing the new technologies and the research on our new energy future. And then things basically stopped through the 80s and the 90s, and nothing was done. And so much of our knowledge that we developed, that we paid for, is being picked up by Denmark, by Germany, by countries all over the world. And it hasn't been until really the last two and a half years, maybe the last 3 years, that we have basically picked up the baton and said, we're going to move forward with this. We're going to do it in a bipartisan way. It's a conservative, progressive American agenda, and we're going to get it done. And I think because of the inescapable forces that I talked about at the beginning, it's not an issue that's going to go away in 2 years or 5 years, but it's a forever issue for us.
There was a time when GM was 18 months ahead of Toyota in developing hybrid cars. Unfortunately, they didn't follow that lead, but they could. And there are a lot of very interesting battery technologies. We don't know yet how well they'll work or what they'll cost. We just know batteries are difficult, but there's a lot of good brain power going at it. I think, Senator, the main issue you're going to have to deal with your colleagues on the cap and trade is, do we continue to indulge in ancestor worship by grandfathering those who are already emitting carbon? An economist would say a carbon atom is the same coming from a new source or an old source, and if we give permits to those who are already polluting but require new polluters to pay for it, we're really distorting the market. Seriously, giving a free pass to people who've already been emitting free for a long time and suppressing competition and new market entry. So as a free marketeer, I very much hope we will not grandfather anybody but auction all the permits.
I'm going to deem the questions answered and the session closed. And thank you very much for your attention.